When is the news going to be about something besides fear? From finance now to milk from China, more than a dozen countries and the entire European Union are recalling or banning Chinese milk products after reports of high levels of melamine. That's a chemical that has contaminated baby formula in China. Thousands of Chinese children are sick. At least four died. Worries about Chinese milk are spreading here, too, especially in Asian American communities. KQED's Wan Ha reports.
Three products, a popular Chinese candy, a yogurt drink from China, and instant coffee from Taiwan were recalled by their American importers. FDA testing detected melamine in the yogurt drink, while tests by state health officials found melamine in the candy. Walmart sells the candy in selected stores in 18 states. All of the products are usually carried in Asian grocery stores. At the Ocean Supermarket in the Northern California city of Milpitas, General Manager Ken Tha shows me the long shelf where he used to stock the popular White Rabbit candy. He said he pulled the candy even before the recall notice arrived because he read about its contamination in Asia.
I was afraid to stock it and the customers are afraid to buy it. Right now, we're not ordering candy from China as much, especially sweets with milk powder.
I'm inside the Haitan Supermarket in San Jose. Right here in the middle of the store is an open box full of White Rabbit candy for sale. On an earlier visit, I actually saw one bag that had already been opened. I asked store owner Tan Jun if he knows about the recall. I heard about it, but I've been very busy, he says. Didn't have a chance to take it down. I forgot. The owner throws down an empty box and scoops up bags of White Rabbit candy off the shelf. A spokeswoman for Walmart said the company pulled White Rabbit candy off its shelves last Wednesday. That's 5 days after the recall was issued. The Food and Drug Administration enforces product recalls such as these by working with distributors to notify retailers and going out to stores. But consumer groups complain that products often stay on the shelf, even after recalls.
You know, FDA does not have the inspection workforce needed to enforce any recalls or any public health advisories they issue.
Tony Corbo is with the consumer group Food and Water Watch.
Some folks are going to try to get away with not recalling on their own, and they may not do it until somebody from the FDA shows up, and it may be months from now.
Food and Water Watch is calling on the FDA to follow the European Union's lead to ban certain milk products from China. FDA spokeswoman Stephanie Kwisnik says that FDA investigators are going out to stores every day to sample and test products that contain milk and milk ingredients from China. Ingesting melamine is harmful to the kidneys, but on Friday, the FDA reassured the public that tiny amounts of melamine in food isn't likely to cause harm, except when it's in infant formula. Chinese infant formula is not sold in this country. And as of yet, there have been no reports of illnesses in the U.S. related to melamine. But the list of contaminated food items is likely to grow. This Japanese commercial is for Koala March cookies. Asian grocery stores here and a small number of Walmart stores in 41 states carry them. But they've been recalled in Canada and several other countries because tests detected melamine in them. Walmart pulled the cookies off the shelves even though they are not recalled in the U.S. The FDA says it's in the process of testing them. For NPR News, I'm Wan Ha in San Jose, California.
We're going to stay in Alaska now for an unusual celebration.
Potato, 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 potato.
This is the International Year of the Potato. Close listeners to this program will remember we talked about that as 2007 turned into 2008. Well, Bill Campbell in Palmer, Alaska, has chosen tonight to honor the potato in a special way. Bill, what are you doing?
I'm hosting what I'm calling the Palmer Potato Pageant at the Railroad Depot in Palmer.
So, well, what's going to be going on tonight at the pageant?
I'm hoping lots of people come and bring potatoes that are funny looking, and we could give them all cheers. Some friends decided they could bring some potluck foods for things to munch on. I have lots of potato paraphernalia, and there's some potato poems and potato songs and potato jokes and paper for kids to color, potato pictures on.
Just about everything.
Kind of whatever. Just a big potato party.
Now, you said potato poems.
I've been working with potatoes, 20, 30 years. And over the time, I've turned up some poems here and there that just celebrate, talk about the potato, and several are titled Ode to the Potato.
Do you have part of a poem there, Bill, that you might read for us?
Yes, I do. One published in the American Potato Journal starts off, "Once the potato, served some way, was on our tables thrice each day. At breakfast time, we ate it fried and stowed it generously inside. At noon, we ate it boiled and mashed. At night, we often had it hashed. For in those days, we seemed to feel that spuds were needed at each meal."
That's great.
Yeah.
Did you say you're having an ugliest potato contest?
Yeah. In digging my own potatoes, I didn't do the water correctly, and so I have lots of knobs and things. So I have Jimmy Durante, and I've got ducks, and I've got all kinds of funny-looking shapes. And some of the commercial guys here, from time to time, you hit a bad hill, and there's some real ugly things there. And they're just kind of fun to show off. So I thought we'd see who could bring the weirdest-looking potato, the ones with the most arms and legs, and make little potato monsters out of them.
And you figure there are enough potato growers around there in Palmer to give you some competition?
Oh, yeah. There's four or five commercial guys locally, and then almost everyone has a garden, and potatoes make up a significant portion of folks' garden.
And you're a state agronomist. You actually get to work with potatoes. You don't just love them, but it's your life's work.
Yeah, my daughter and son, hey, taking them to a couple of potato meetings and tease me about, geez, Dad, how can you talk about potatoes for a week? It's just an amazing thing. You do all this work and you don't have a clue what's going on until the fall when you dig them up. And then I had kids and kids, it's a buried treasure. And, oh, what's under this one?
I remember digging up potatoes when I was a little girl with my uncle, and it was like magic what you'd find under there.
Yeah, there are all kinds of weird shapes and sizes, and we've been working with a bunch of different stock, what we're calling the colored flesh potatoes. So we have reds and purples and all kinds of different color marblings on the outside, real bright yellow fleshes and different flavors. So they're just fun.
Any idea how many people are coming tonight?
Well, it started out with maybe 30 or 40, and then the article showed up in the paper, and the phone's been ringing, so I have no idea, maybe a couple hundred people.
Sounds like a big time.
Well, yeah, it's a small town, and we're just, you know, having some fun. So my poster I put up was, "Come and show off your ugly potatoes, your big potatoes. We'll sing potato songs, potato haiku, potato poems, and have potato fun." So
thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Melissa. It's real fun.
Potato promoter Bill Campbell, state agronomist in Palmer, Alaska. He's hosting the Palmer Potato Pageant tonight.
I imagine them under their acres, out in Idaho and up in Maine. Maybe wondering if they'll be bakers, or canishes, or latkes, or plain. Potato, 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 potato. Potato, 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 potato.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Now we're going to examine one facet of the presidential race that has received little attention. As the old saying goes, the best way to a man's heart is through his stomach. We figured we could learn more about the candidates by finding out what they like to eat. So we dispatched NPR's Daniel Zwerdling to investigate. Next week, he'll go to Annapolis, Maryland, to cook with one of John McCain's favorite chefs. Today, Danny kicks off the series at one of Barack Obama's favorite spots.
Okay, so everybody, please close your eyes, because I want you to pretend this is not Sunday morning. It's nighttime. You're sitting on a soft banquette. The room is glowing with candles. There are bold modern paintings on the walls. The waiters mix your margaritas at your table. And this is where the Obamas come for a special night out in Chicago. It's called Topola Bampo. It's a Mexican restaurant. It's named for a Mexican port. But the cooking here is totally different than what you find in most Mexican restaurants in the United States. Listen, the waiter's bringing the appetizers.
Excellent. So for the two of you, we have pulpo en su tinta. Pulpo, of course, being the grilled baby octopus that's served chilled. In the center there, the smaller egg is a poached quail egg. And the
At
larger
Topola Bampo, don't even think about burritos and refried beans. The truth is, the food most Americans think of as Mexican is actually Tex-Mex food. It's the rustic cooking that farmers and cowboys ate along the border. When Topola Bampo opened almost 20 years ago, it was the first restaurant in the United States that served the kind of gourmet dishes you might find in Mexico City.
And finally, for yourself here,
it's won all kinds of awards.
Green nasturtium leaf as well as fuchsia flowers, all tossed in a chamomile dressing, or more commonly known as manzanilla, very, very common in Mexico, rest over a little bit of smoked chicken.
The chef behind all this is Rick Bayless. He's got glasses and a reddish goatee. He's super fit. Bayless has written 6 cookbooks, and he has a cooking show on TV.
So the Obamas, they really, truly eat here?
They really do, and have been eating here for years and years.
So do they have their usual table, like they walk in and you see them in the corner over there? Or
they used to sit in the front part of the room where they were completely on display, and now they have moved toward the back, this table right here.
And favorite dishes?
I couldn't say that they have any favorite dishes. They just like to explore the whole menu. They're our favorite kind of customer because they say, what's new on the menu? What can we try? And they're very laid back customers. They don't eat quickly. They really enjoy themselves. They stay at the table a long time and just seem to enjoy the flavors.
So maybe we should go up to the kitchen.
Let's
and you
it.
Can cook and we'll
Let's
talk.
We're here in our test kitchen. This is where we develop all the recipes for books and TV shows and things like that.
So here's what I really want to know. How did a boy from Kansas City, like you, end up being one of the main people who showed Americans what real Mexican cooking is really about?
Could you state that with Oklahoma City in there?
Oklahoma City, sorry.
Okay. You know, I went to Mexico when I was a teenager, and I just fell in love with it. It was like tasting the most mysterious food I had ever tasted, but it didn't taste weird. It tasted deliciously mysterious. And I just came back from there.
You mean like yesterday?
Yesterday. And it still does all the same things to me that it did to me at 14. It makes my blood course through my body. I find it so exciting. I find the culture so vibrant and quirky and fun. And the flavors just like leap off the plate. When you're walking down the street, you always come across a street stall. And they're gorgeous to look at. Most people think of street food as something that's sort of down and dirty, but in Mexico City, street food has been sort of raised to an art form. They do some of the most beautiful and most complex dishes in the street stalls, and they do them in a way that they're so incredibly satisfying.
Bela says, actually, why don't we cook one of his favorite street foods? Because the dishes he serves downstairs are too elaborate. So over the next few minutes, he's going to teach you to make steak tortillas with grilled onions and guacamole, the way Mexicans really eat them. First, a quick marinade for the skirt steak.
I'm going to take a small piece of onion and put it in a food processor here. Some garlic cloves in there as well. And now lime juice, salt, and a touch of cumin are going to be the main flavorings in this marinade for skirt steak.
And by the way, do the Obamas ever eat this skirt steak recipe here?
The first time that I ever met Michelle, she was eating a skirt steak taco here.
Next, Bela slices some onion in big, thick rings, and he brushes them with oil.
I'm going to put those on the grill over here.
Then he cuts some tomatillos in half, and he puts them on the grill. Have you ever used tomatillos? They look like tomatoes, but they're green and sort of sticky. It used to be hard to find them in the States, but the Hispanic population's grown so much.
Now you can find tomatillos in practically any grocery store anywhere in the country.
When the tomatillos are soft, he's going to mush them with the avocados to make the guacamole.
It adds a slight smokiness to the guacamole, which I think is super delicious.
So what makes the Mexican cooking that you brought back to the United States so different than the places that are, you know, in every neighborhood in America, these swamps of refried beans and sour cream and melted cheese?
Well, I love that food, too. And when I go back to Oklahoma City to visit my family, we always go eat Tex-Mex food, and I love it. The reason our food is so different is that all that fat that you get from the sour cream and the cheese and the really fatty beans really dulls flavors. And the
dulls?
It dulls flavors. And the food in Mexico is much leaner than all of that Mexican-American food. The hallmark of real Mexican food is freshness. And when you go into the Mexican markets, you see these mounds and mounds of tomatillos and tomatoes and onions and garlic and all kinds of greens. And they're very ripe. They're to be used that day.
Okay. What are you going to do next?
Okay, scoop out the avocado from the skin.
And then Bayless mashes the avocado with the tomatillo sauce he made in the blender. But he says don't mash too much.
I like guacamole to be coarse.
Rick Bayless almost became an academic instead of a chef. He went to Mexico to do the research for his PhD.
So I'm picturing you there in Mexico studying anthropology and linguistics, sitting down to a meal in a little cafe and suddenly thinking, I should do this for a living.
It actually happened in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when I was in graduate school, and I walked into one of my classes, and I had been cooking for a catering party, and I smelled of garlic from head to toe. And somebody looked up and said, wow, that's some garlic smell. And I realized that the garlic smell was what got me out of bed in the morning, not what we were studying in the class. And I left that class, and I never really looked back. Okay, I've got to go over and check the onions. And right next to them here, I'm going to put the steaks on the grill as well.
What were you studying in that class?
It was this really arcane thing about Mexican history reported by the Spaniards during the first 50 years of their conquest.
But you know what's really puzzling? It's like Americans totally fell in love with French cooking, and French cooking became a huge deal in the United States. Italian cooking, huge deal in the United States. Right across the border, they have this incredible cuisine. You know, why didn't Americans fall in love with that sooner?
Well, I think you're getting into very deep sociological waters here, but I do feel like that the U.S. has always felt beholden to everything European, and that we were the poor stepchildren across the Atlantic, and they had all the culture. We don't have any of those feelings toward Mexico. And in fact, people are incredibly surprised, I think, when they go to Mexico and they find that there are even markets there. I mean, they consider it to be such a poor country, such a cultureless type of place that they can't imagine that it could really have anything to offer to us, let alone teach to us. We're about ready here. I'm going to... Okay, let's pull that skirt steak off.
I'm cheating. That is delicious. This is my last Obama question.
Okay.
If he becomes president, mm-hmm. will you become the White House chef?
I'm not sure that would ever happen, but I would love to be involved with the Obamas in some way. I think we could kind of spice up some of that state fair, you know?
Rick Bayless brings out some plates and a basket of hot homemade tortillas.
Put a little of the meat and the onions.
We pile on thick slices of that skirt steak and onions.
Of that roasted tomatillo guacamole.
And then we spoon mounds of fabulous, chunky, smoky guacamole.
Squeeze on a little bit of lime.
Over everything.
That's what it's all about.
Oh, by the way, Leanne, I packed a doggy bag for you so you could enjoy these tacos too. But I ate them on the plane.
Well, thanks a lot, pal. That's NPR's Daniel Zwerdling. You can watch Rick Bayless make this dish at npr.org. You can also print out the recipe. Next week, our intrepid reporter cooks with the chef at one of John McCain's favorite restaurants. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. For my wedding in 1982, I ordered a Carvel ice cream cake. The Carvel brand, famous for its soft serve ice cream, has been around since 1936. The legend is that Tom Carvel's ice cream truck broke down, the product started to melt, but customers liked it soft. So Carvel opened his first store in the same spot where the truck broke down. That store in Hartsdale, New York, closes today. Abdul Faghihi has owned the store for the past 21 years. He's on the phone. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Has anyone ordered a wedding cake recently?
Not recently wedding cake, but we have plenty of cakes that we have been selling.
Birthday cakes, Fudgy the Whale.
Fudgy the Whale, Hug Me the Bear, Cookie Puss.
Oh, Cookie Puss.
Tom Carvel had so many different cakes.
Why do you have to close?
Basically, we had a lease here for 20 years. And the property was sold to, you know, investors who is putting their own restaurant on it.
Are you getting a lot of customers this weekend?
Recently, I have so many customers coming in. They're expressing their sadness that it's closing, and they're taking pictures of the place. Quite few people bring their kids, and they take pictures. And I had some older couples, believe it or not, like in late 70s, and they told me that they met each other in this store and they wanted to visit it one more time.
Do you have customers there now?
Yes, I do.
Do you think I could talk to one of them or to? Can you pass the phone over?
Sure. Hold on a second. Hello, who's this?
Hi, this is Leanne Hansen at National Public Radio. Who's this?
This is Mike Greco.
What are you buying at Carvel today?
I don't know yet. I'm just taking in the that famous smell that this place has.
Oh, what is it?
Like ice cream.
How long have you been going to the store?
The last time I was here was when I worked at Abraham and Strauss in White Plains back in 1980. Honestly, just forgot about this whole place until I heard that it was going down.
Oh, so you had to go back.
Yeah, we're going back. Came back with my friend Annie, and, you know, we're not even supposed to be eating ice cream. But we got to have the last Carvel, you know?
Yeah. I understand. Thank you. Could I talk to Abdul again?
Sure. Hello?
Hi, Abdul.
Yes.
One last question.
What?
What do you think Tom Carvel would have to say about his first store shutting down?
Oh, if he was alive, I am pretty sure that he would have put the money down and keep it. Unfortunately, you know, Tom Carvel had no children, and he left everything for a charity, and they sold the place.
Ah, so...
That's how it worked out.
Abdul Faghihi is the owner of the country's first Carvel ice cream store in Hartsdale, New York. The store closes today. Thank you and good luck to you.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. Have a nice day.
This is NPR News.